Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the 56th episode of Edu All-Stars. My name is Todd Nesloni. You can find me on Twitter at TechNinjaTodd. Here with me today with my co-host is...
My name is Chris Kessler. You can find me on Twitter at IamKessler. And we just want to thank everyone for joining the podcast this evening, and welcome back. Thanks for all the great reviews that you left on iTunes. Those are super appreciated. Any comments you make on the blog are also appreciated, and it just definitely motivates to keep on going.
And Keegan is still a co-host of Edu All Stars, but his computer is now broke this week, so he is not with us again this week. He set a new record for co-host, but not being here. He's still part of the show, and we would like to thank Sophia for sponsoring this episode of Edu All Stars. Sophia is all about transforming education through an online community of teachers and learners. They make tons of great videos, and I have teachers that have other made videos. Bill Nye the Science Guy works with them, and they're someone that I've used to help flip my classroom. So they do flip class certifications, iPad certifications, Chromebook, virtual classroom. It's just a great resource, and we encourage you to check them out. You can follow the link on our blog or check them out at sophia.org, S-O-P-H-I-A. And as you listen to this week's episode, we want to encourage you to tweet using the hashtag EduAllStars. We love seeing the conversation and hearing about the different things that stick out to you. We are so excited for this week's guest. We have Ginger Lumen, who was a public school teacher for 19 years and is now working with ESTAC. She is a firm believer in project-based learning, and we can't wait to hear more about her on the show today. So, Ginger, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Oh, I am so excited to be here. I've listened to several of your videos and interviews, and I'm trying to psych myself up to do as good a job as all those other all-stars. I'm thinking, thanks for having me on.
Well, I guess the best place to start, like normal, is just tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into education.
Todd, I love you. I tell the story how I got into education is I got into it pretty dishonestly. I'm the kid who in class, you liked having me in class and you hated having me in class. I was the kid who didn't do my homework, but still aced the test. And I participated in class, you know, and the teacher, you know, when there's a lull and nobody's answering, my hand will come up, and I'll always answer the question and that sort of thing. So I laughed at the teacher's jokes. So teachers love me. See, I learned pretty early that if the teachers liked me, I could get away with anything I wanted to. I learned that as early as I did. third grade, the meanest teacher in the whole school caught me sliding down the stairway banister. Now, Todd, you're a little young. Chris, I'm not going to go there with you because I don't know you personally. But this is like in the late 70s, early 80s. The meanest teacher in the school in a rural area catches you sliding down the stairway banister. What's going to happen to you? Yeah, you're getting swats, right?
Yeah,
and I knew that if I got two swats at school, I'm getting four when I get home, and my dad's not nice, right? So Mrs. Hobbs was her name, Jenny Hobbs. She caught me sliding down the stairway banister. She says, "Ginger!" Man, I hopped off of that banister and maybe leaked a little, I don't know. And she said, "Ginger, you know better than that." And she walked on, right? Of course, I don't think anything because I'm a third grader, right? Don't really have any brains in my head. I just go on about my life. But in junior high... I'm still that kid who walk into class. By the way, I'm making almost all A's. You know, a couple of B's, but mostly straight A's. Walk into class, looking through my notebook. You know, teacher says, "Turn in your homework." I'm looking. You know, it's not here. Totally in a panic, knowing I'd never done that homework, right? And again, in the mid '80s, what do the teachers say to you, to a good kid? She says things like, you know, "Oh, turn it in tomorrow," and I might. Am I not? You know, it doesn't matter. That test is what I'm going to ace. You know, I can choose what I do and what I don't do. And I go all the way through school like this, right? I'm a smart kid, so I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to take all the way through calculus, right? And math's never been my strong suit. Now that I've known a little bit more about education, about the way people learn, I've done some self-diagnosis with some dyslexia issues, but you didn't see them with me because I could quick catch and switch things around. They're masked. Anyway, and so there I am in my freshman Algebra 1 class, and Coach Miller, bless his heart, would say, you know, hey, everybody, turn in your homework. And so I'd pull out my blank sheet of paper. And but he'd say, but are there any questions ahead of time? And he'd work out problems on the board. I'm writing them down, you know. I'm passing all the homework, but when we get to the test, I'm failing in math, right? I go all the way through high school math that way, except for geometry. Geometry, actually, teacher never let us sit down. He said, go to the board and get to work and work at your own pace. And I went to geometry contest. Yeah, I'm a nerd. And went to what, 52 out of 52 schools, I got something like second place or something, whatever. I learned pretty early that I could cheat. And did, because what my parents had told me and all my family and everybody had told me is, we're not going to pay for your college. Everybody who gets their college paid for just blows it off, and so you better get scholarships. And so how you get scholarships, you get grades. So I went to school to get grades. I wasn't there to learn. And I knew how to get grades. I'm good at getting grades, right? And so there I go, and going to college, and I think, what can I be? What can I do? I can do just about anything, but I want to make sure that I have a decent paycheck always. So I'll be a teacher because, you know what teaching is, and it's pretty easy, right? So there I am. go through college a lot like I did in high school. Just getting the grade, doesn't matter how I get it. Get my degree, I get out. Social science, right? I'm teaching middle school, high school, social studies classes, American history, world history, American government, those sorts of things. And I'm noticing the back of my classroom that there are kids sitting there who are just like me in the school. And I'm like, man, I'm not having that. I am not having that. And and started, you know, finding ways to kick their butts with love. And I ran into this concept of gifted ed. And I thought, okay, let's find out about these kids. I was identified for gifted when I was in first grade. And mom and dad said, Ginger needs to be able to get along with all people. So, no, she can't go into the program. And I'm 42, and I'm like, how will that work out, Mom and Dad? How do you get along with other people? And I know what it's like to go through school just sliding by. And got my master's in gifted ed and worked in that field as a teacher, and then as well also as a local, state, and even federal advocate for gifted and talented programs. And about that same time, my district had run into, the state of Kansas, actually the whole nation, had a good amount of money in education. It was about 2004, our district started talking about charter school money. And in Kansas, our charter schools are different. We're public school. We're blessed by the district. The only thing that's different is that they didn't have to follow all the same rules. And the school said, hey, we got kids here who want to learn, but for whatever reason, they're not. And so they said, let's start a new school. And they put it. I was interested. I mean, I was all over that. Like listening, I wanted to work there. But I got a phone call one day, and they're like, "Hey, why don't you come be the director of the school?" And I laughed. I mean, I straight up laughed. It's my boss now. Anyway, I laughed. I laughed, and I said, "Absolutely, no way. I'm just a teacher. I'm not an administrator." And she says, Are you opposed to even talking about it? And I said, well, I'll talk to you. And at that point, I knew I was interviewing them. And so I went to the interview, and I'm sitting there with a lady named Deb Haneke and a guy named Kevin Honeycutt. And that guy's weird, right? He's over there talking about the energy of the school and things. And I'm like, he's testing me in this interview. You know, I'm digging it, right? But I can't show that in an interview, the energy of the school. And, you know, it's 100 years old. I'm not going there in an interview. I don't know, I asked them about 50 questions, and almost every answer they gave me was, I don't know, what would you like to do? And I thought, are you kidding me? I can put together a school that does the right thing for kids? And they said, yeah, it's got to be project-based learning, and it's one-to-one laptop. We started this in 2006, and I'm not stupid. I took a sabbatical. So in case things went wrong, I, like, bugged out. Yeah, that first day of school was horrible, man. The kids were just staring at me. I didn't know what I was doing at all. I had 2 days of training with the Buck Institute and a summer to prepare. And they're like, go ahead and start it. And I had grades five through eight altogether. I'm the only teacher, right? And and when I say grades 5 through 8, that's kind of a misnomer, because I had kids who had learned pretty early that if they acted foolish, they got set out in the hallway, and they did that for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I had 8th graders who were brilliant and should have been in high school. So I had really grades 4 through 10 all together, all classes, all, everything, and me. Yeah. Remember social studies teacher here? So,
hey, so before,
first day of school, kids.
Oh, yeah, before we dive deeper into the rest of the story, talk about what project-based learning is, because there's a lot of people out there that have I think it can mean a lot of things to different people. I just want to hear what your definition of project-based learning is.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. I think at its root, project-based learning is learning by doing. If I have a thing that I want to know how to do, or a problem I want to solve, a question I want to answer, and then I have to learn in order to do that, that's project-based learning. I think there's 100 billion different, okay, math challenged. I think there's a lot of different ways to do project-based learning, and I think there's a lot of ways to do it right. I think there's some ways to do it wrong, too, but at its root, every single project-based learning is about learning by doing, not learning and then doing. So that's, yeah. I specialize in working with reluctant teachers, I think.
So you talked about you just had a couple of days of training on PBL. Like, how did you get started? Like, what was the first thing you did? You're sitting with these classes. Like, all right, we're ready to go. What, you know, how did you get going on that?
First thing we did was unpack the computers. The first day of school, we took them out of their boxes. Really, awesome. When I had that 2 days of training with the Buck Institute, you walk away with a project done or really close to being done with them, and that's really nice to have. And I had exactly one good project that first year. I have one, and it was the one that I'd planned with them. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was are we safe in Kansas from earthquakes? And at the time, we didn't have earthquakes in Kansas, really. Now we do a lot more. We're not going
so
there.
So do you blame that on lack of education then, that you just didn't have any and you were kind of on your own, and at this point it was basically brand new in schools?
I'm not sure that it's brand new in schools, but I know that there weren't a lot of schools doing it. It was about March of that year, 2007, when Kevin said, hey, you gotta get on this thing called Classroom 2.0 and this thing called Twitter. You got to get there. And that's when the world opened up. And for a couple of years, I still didn't see anybody who was doing what we were doing. I saw project-based learning happening in high schools in a classroom here and there. There was not a full school doing it. And I think if they were, I would have seen them at that middle school level. The terminology of an educational detached retina, that was definitely what we were, even with Twitter and Classroom 2.0, which helped a lot. But that first year, I really believe that when teachers first go into project-based learning, there's a huge amount of unlearning that happens, not only in the teacher, but also in the kids. And I don't want to fault that at all in anybody. I want them to recognize that that is still learning, that you're not going to do perfect stuff right away. And if you do, you're probably not doing it right, you know? That the kids and I learned a whole, and the parents, oh my gosh, we learned so much that first year, and the first and second year too. Finally, about the third year, I had a decent handle on what was going on.
Now, Ginger, you also, you've created your own kind of PBL package, life practice model. Can you tell us more about the life practice model, and does it differ from PBL? Is it similar, or how did that come about?
Absolutely. So I've been running this school. We started with 16 kids, went to 11 kids because we didn't realize we had to get people to come. And then the third year we went to 25. Yeah. And the next year we went to 25 kids, and I hired another staff member. Next year we went to 54. I hired 2 more staff members. And then the next year went to 74. I hired 2 more staff members. And in that time, I had teachers who were coming on board saying, how do we do this? And I'd be like, come into my classroom and just look, because I didn't know how to train people, and we weren't sending people to the Buck Institute anymore. And so they were learning by doing it. Thank God I hired awesome teachers who were like, okay. And when I finally stepped away from the school, it was 2011. We were K through 8 at that time, and I was in the process of building a high school. I went on to go into the ESDAC offices, which is an educational service center, and I said, I got to teach people how to do this. And there's a lot of stuff online. 2011, now, there's a lot of stuff online that's amazing, beautiful project-based learning. And I knew that going through it and learning it and talking with my new teachers that so many, and of course being on Twitter and on Facebook and connecting with a lot of other teachers, that we look at those beautiful projects. And as a teacher who, I mean, if you're game, jump in and go. But a lot of teachers see those beautiful things and say, oh, but I still have those tests. I mean, we were doing PBL in the depths of No Child Left Behind. And Kevin would come in and say, hey, do this really fun thing. And I'd say, okay, we can do that. And he said, I'll bet if you do enough of these, probably by the end of the year, you'll have hit enough standards. And I said, that's probably is not acceptable. I've got parents staring me in the face, right? I got the kids who are going to the regular town high school after this. My kids had better friggin' shine knowing stuff, as well as being good learners. And so I realized that is a... that's a real chasm in the world, that we have teachers over here on one cliff who are saying, I want to get over here to PBL. And people are like, here's where it is. Jump over here. And they build beautiful stuff, and it's great PBL. But sometimes when they leap, they're like, ah, right? Yeah, yeah. And then we say, well, you're just a bad teacher, or, you know, or some didn't quite. And so what I'd hope to have done, and Kevin, that both of us have done, is to build that bridge across. We catch grief sometimes. Our life practice PBL cards, and I call them recipe cards just because what it looks like. But if you read them, they're so not a recipe. It's not step one, step two, step three at all. We catch grief because they say it smells too much like school. And I felt bad for that for a long time because I talk about doing PBL, but then I thought to myself, it's that bridge. There's a lot of beautiful PBL out there. Go for it. But we have so many teachers in this world who don't know how to get there. And so if I walk them across, I'll do so unapologetically because they're going to get there. Because the other way, they're not getting it. And so I'll let them smell like school. And when we do trainings and we work, I say, now listen, this is a great starter. This is not where you end. You end over here with these things, but you're not going to feel it unless you start walking across. So that's our life practice PBL model.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that about the standards because I'm thinking of my eighth grade science standards that I have to hit. You know, like some of these standards are, you know, I've got 3 days to teach atoms. Like how in the hell am I going to teach about atoms in 3 days in our scope and sequence? And so like project-based learning has always been – you have something? So it's always been something like – well, that's what the teachers with no standards get to do kind of thing. And I'm still stuck here doing my, you know, my Texas State standards. So I'm glad that you did mention that there can be smaller projects. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, 6 week long project that, you know, that you have to do, that, those kinds of things. So what are some of the challenges that come along?
First of all, our kids aren't ready for that.
No, they're not. Not my, not eighth graders at least. So I imagine that's going countrywide.
We can do that. Got to walk them into it. It works.
Yeah. This is kind of a two-parter. Like, I guess the first thing is what are some of the challenges that you found with PBL? And then also, does PBL work with all levels of learners, not just the GT kids, but every single level?
I'm going to say, I forgot the first question because you hit me with the second one that I really am passionate about.
Okay, hit the second one. I'll go back.
I knew it.
You can't do that one for me. You got to eat one at a time. I manage things, but okay.
Okay.
With all levels of learners, I believe that it's good for, I've got to say, 99% of our learners. Because when I say all levels of learners, somebody all of a sudden starts thinking about the kid who's a nonverbal, who may still be the biters and scratchers. Mm-hmm. And I can't say I have expertise in that area. I'm not going to say they can or can't. I don't know. But I think with the typical students in a special education classroom all the way into gifted, abs-a-stinkin-lutely, I think they all need it. I think our world needs them to be thinkers, learners, doers, makers. And that's where that, yes, they can. My students, my school, now, again, I want us to be aware, yeah, I came from a gifted background, and that really helped me to understand that I'm going to build a super high-level curriculum first and then scaffold them up there no matter who my kids are. I'm going to build the amazing stuff first. I had students who had IEPs for learning disabilities. I had students IEPs for gifted. I had, out of my 74 kids when I left, 10 of them, had a Asperger's diagnosis. And they weren't receiving services because we met those services. We were able to differentiate within their work to help them feel confident and successful and actually be successful as learners.
And you know, I totally agree with that as well, because that's the same thing that happened in my class by doing a PBL model. Is I had 75 students this year, and we had students who had special education services, but once you immerse them in that kind of learning, those kids don't need the same services that they needed in their previous environment. Many times a special education teacher just became somebody who stood over their shoulder just to kind of hang out and say, do you need help? And many times special education kids would say, I got this. I have my peers around me. We can do this. We've got it. I'm good. And it's crazy to watch that happen. And it doesn't – if you're a teacher who's been in this other mindset for so long, it doesn't make sense to you that that would happen, because you think, well, no, they're going to sit there because they're not going to get it, and they're going to get left behind, and their group's going to get frustrated with them, and da-da-da-da. But that doesn't happen. The kids – they work together, and those special education students, because in my class it was, I don't care what's going on, you all are on a level playing field, and you're all going to put in the same fourth of effort, and you all are going to get there successfully. And so there was no, oh, well, I get special services, so I need you to do these. But it was like, no, I will help you along the way if you need it, but you're going to put in the same amount of effort as the people around you. You're not going to let this title define your type of learning skills.
Yeah. Well, I want every kid. I'm glad that you said that every kid puts in effort, because right now our bright kids aren't putting in hardly any effort and still making top grades, whereas our other kids who, when they're younger, put in a lot of effort, but learn pretty quickly. I don't. No matter how much effort I put in, I'm never going to be successful in the teacher's eyes, so why even try? You know. I think that's really important. I think that grouping really matters. I'm extremely passionate about how we should be grouping kids, because I think how most of education is asking kids to be grouped, it creates bullies, it creates havoc, it isn't helping anyone, it's only hurting. When we go high, medium, and low in a group, it's unfair to everyone.
So you think homogeneous grouping is definitely the way to go? Is that what you're saying?
How much time do we have? I'll make this quick.
How about a yes or no?
Yes and no.
Okay. All right.
I can't go one way or the other.
No, you got all the time in the world.
Oh, I love that you say that. I'm looking for the shepherd's hook.
You don't tell her that she has all the time in the world, Chris. You just don't.
I've got a friend named Todd. He's a very good friend of mine. Thanks, Todd. You're going to come out the hero in the end here. and I don't know if y'all know me or not, but I'm not necessarily the most fit person in the world. So I asked my friend Todd. I said, "Hey, would you help me go to the gym and get a little more fit?" And Todd's a nice guy, so he says, "Absolutely." And I'm like, "Cool." We get to the gym. We're working out. Like 10 minutes into it, he's all like, "Yeah, man, come on, you can do this, Ginger." And I'm like, dying. I mean, 10 minutes in, I'm sweating, trying to hold my breath in. It's not holding in. Quite frankly, I'm not really appreciating his "let's do it" attitude. And even though I asked him to be there, you know, I love him, so I'm still trying. And we're going through this. The longer we're going into it, the more I'm starting to hate on him, right? He's not even sweating, and I am drenched, right? And finally, by the end of this, we go out to the parking lot, and Todd's like, "Good job, Ginge." And I'm like, "Thanks, man." And I get in my car. He gets in his car. I drive away. He gets out of his car, goes back inside, and gets a real workout. Because we got with me, it was not a workout for him at all. Mm-hmm. You see, I would much rather work out with people who are fatties like me And that way I can really, like, work really, really hard and feel okay because nobody else is... Because what would happen if Todd wasn't a nice guy? What happens to me? And what happens to Todd if I'm not a nice person? Right? If I'm not a nice person, I'm going to hamstring him every chance I get, right? So I think that we should be grouping kids according to ability a lot more than we are right now. But that being said,
great visual analogy, the one you just gave. I mean, I've never thought of it like that, but yeah. That's like the perfect explanation of it, and it makes total sense when you put it that way.
I'll definitely be stealing that story for sure. Yeah.
I'll give you credit.
But that being said, you know, you got to be careful because then you're creating the haves and have-nots, right?
Sure.
And so then how do we get them to group heterogeneously with purpose, not just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5s, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, whatever. And so I really believe that interest grouping really matters. So if you have kids who, you know, we're looking at technology, video gaming, we're talking about social issues, fashion, sports, music. I mean, there's a lot of different things that will hit every single kid in a class. So if you can get them grouped around those sorts of topics or even the topic within the subject area and get them hooked into that, now the kids are coming together cross-ability. And if they're interested in the topic, do you think they're going to bring something to the table? The low ability? No, absolutely. No. Yeah. And now what we're doing is we're creating a respect in the classroom because our high ability kids are like, whoa, I had no idea that you had this to offer, man. And they start looking at each other differently. And the other kid's like, heck yeah, man, I own this. It's differentiated 101. It's not PBL per se, but if we don't do it that way, then we're harming kids more than doing good, I believe. I'm a little passionate about this.
So, Ginger, thinking about some of the biggest challenges that you face as a teacher and that you see other teachers facing as you go around and talk to them about PBL, what do you see as the biggest challenges with somebody trying to implement this?
There's a lot of challenges. I think leadership matters. I know that. I have actually done walkthroughs with principals before, just looking in classrooms where a teacher's doing amazing stuff, and had the principal walk out and say, I'm really disappointed. I've talked with principals about some of the work that we do with our project-based learning. Principals who like to think they get it, but when they see what we're doing, say, for instance, a Viking ship, right? That's something I show a lot. And they walk, and they don't walk out. They say, this is really nice, Ginger, but I need my kids doing more than arts and crafts. What they saw was the thing that hooked the kids. They weren't paying attention to the learning that was happening in between. If you ever wanted to really get inside a kid's head, and find out what's going on with them, have them do some coloring, right? The coloring isn't what matters. It's the conversation that happens while their hands are busy elsewhere. So the learning that we can Trojan horse in when they're doing these things that look crafty, the kids think they're just building a ship. Man, they're learning a lot more than that. And so leadership to me is so vitally important. The other problems, the technical problems, like how do we grade, how do we assess, how do we put this out, those are just things that can be solved with decision making by good leadership and grassroots push. I think that's it.
Cool. So think back to some of your favorite PBL projects that you've done over the years, and just maybe like give us one or two that you really like to keep going back to because it's just amazing. The kids are totally engaged and have a great time with those. And maybe that someone that hasn't heard, I'm sure you talk about projects all the time, but someone that hasn't ever heard about a PBL project before, what would that kind of look like?
Oh, you're killing me. Because I have 56 that I love.
I was going to say, it's like asking to pick your favorite kid or something, huh?
Yeah, exactly. No, I always have a favorite kid. It just depends on what moment of the day it is. they're all my favorites, just which moment. So, I don't know. I guess I just like the PBL that allows multiple entries, that it has a bigger purpose to the world, but yet has some sort of anchoring artifact that kids have to build to make something. We've been doing this for years. I mean, I didn't even realize we were part of the maker movement. But really, if you look back, yeah, we really have been. It just didn't have all the technical aspects to it as the flavor today has. So we've been moving in that area a little bit, Kevin and I have. But anything that they can build big, whether it's an inflatable cell that turns into an underwater biome, that turns into a colony on Mars, if it's a cache that Lewis and Clark would have dug down into the ground as they were going up the Mississippi and the Missouri River to like deposit things so that when they came back, there was like a little convenience store waiting on them, right? But the things that they can build, multiple kids, multiple hands on one thing, really causes a whole different scenario of learning in a classroom. That matters a lot. And the good content can happen too. Absolutely. Should and does happen if you're doing the right things.
Do you have, this is off cuff here, sorry Todd. Do you have PBL projects that are like whole class projects and not specific like small group projects where literally like 30 kids maybe working on this one project at the same time?
Absolutely. Almost every single one of them can be. That's what I like about our lifepracticepbl.org projects, are that you can go, if you have a smaller class of 15 kids or so, 10 kids, 8 kids, if you have a small classroom, everybody hands on one thing. If we've done projects, a whole school, right, 160 kids at a time. That was a K-4 school. We had another one in my school where we had 74 kids at a time, grades 5, 8, working together on one project. Again, multiple entry levels that the kids say, oh, I can't wait, I want to be the person that solves this or builds that. And then it all has a big finish line culminating event at the end. And it doesn't have to be days, weeks, months long. You know, a good project can be 2 days long. It can be 2 months. It can be 2 years. It can go on forever. That's what I love about it so much, is you can really tailor the recipe, the thing that you're building, that the thing you saw on Pinterest on the way home. You're like, I want to feed my family. I'm going to make this with my kids. That you can then say, but these ingredients don't really fit because my kid's allergic to that, or they don't like this, or I love this and they need that. And you just tailor it how you want it. For your kids, your audience, your standards, your needs. The toughest part about PBL sometimes is coming up with the great ideas when you're in the middle of something. And that's, I think, where our projects really help teachers who, one, don't know where to start, or two, are too daggum busy to start really thinking deeply. Right. They can go and browse through the books and say, oh, and I'm going to do this instead. That's okay.
Well, you know, I love what you talked about just then. I had never thought about doing a whole school-wide PBL project or a whole grade level-wise. You know, I'm moving into administrative role where our school is going completely with that kind of learning model, and I'm going to have 8 fourth grade teachers and 8 fifth grade teachers, and thinking about how those 8 teachers could design one big project that they all work and all the hands are on with all the entry levels, like you said, I never thought about that, but that's so interesting and cool, and could send such a great message to the community of our learning is so much bigger than our classroom. When this model of learning is not just something we're doing in the class to try the next biggest fad. Let me show you how we combine an entire grade level of kids, 170 kids together, to do this one learning, and how they all are learning at the same time. My mind is already spinning. I can't wait to go. I know I've been watching the Twitter feed. I know I have 2 of my teachers, Michael and Cassie, watching this right now, and I'm just like, oh, I hope they're hearing this stuff, because I can't wait to go back to my staff and be like, oh, you got to watch this with Ginger, because she's got all these great ideas, and it's exciting right now. This is one of those moments where Chris and I talk about how I know I'm not going to go to sleep for a while now, because my brain's just spinning with ideas.
Well, and then you can also think about, what are my kids, what are my teachers ready for? When I first did the full school at my school at Turning Point, I had the math teacher was crying. She was crying that morning. She was in the bathroom. She was like, I can't do this. I don't know how. I don't know. And we brought her out, and we helped her through it. And by the end of the day, she was like, man, math was the most important part of this whole thing. And it was in her room. And her kids felt that too, and oh, that's a win. Oh, that's a win big time. I had her kids, and we switched kids, and it wasn't about content silos. I mean, one of the things somebody named me the other day was the silo killer. And I said, oh, yeah, because it's about not about age groups. It's not about content groups. It's about learning life, right? We should, if we're getting kids to be ready for life, they should be practicing real life right now, right? And life doesn't come at us at 42-minute increments at a time, one subject at a time, right? So.
So, Ginger, I know you also do a lot of PD, professional development over PBL. And I know that knowing you, your PD is not the typical PD. You immerse the teachers in the style of learning you want them to teach. Can you tell everybody a little bit about some of the professional development that you do and how it is different and how you work with those teachers?
Absolutely. I love to work with reluctant teachers, the ones who aren't sure. The ones who already got, who have it, who drank the Kool-Aid, you don't need me. Let's just answer a few technical questions and get you going, right? Yay. Those who are not sure, oh, I love working with them because it takes a little longer. I know it does. I mean, if you want me to come in one day and change your reluctant teachers, no, ain't happening, right? over time, yeah, we can talk about those. So I work with teachers. I work with go out and do where they practice by doing, and a lot of them are nervous. 30 minutes in to one of our full days, they're already doing work, and they're scared as heck, and I don't think I can do it, and I want them to be there on purpose, because then they will triumph within an hour, and then we go back and dissect what it was we did, you know, learning by doing. And so then they get to see from the point of view of a student and then as a teacher, really microcosm, and then we expand further and hang all our hats and learning on that experience and then have other learning experiences. Recently, though, we've been pushing into the maker space area and STEAM maker, and I've decided that if we want kids to be able to do that in schools and teachers know how to do that, because so many times teachers will say, well, this doesn't work with, I mean, it works with your kids, but it won't work with mine for fill in the blank reason. They're too smart. They're too brown. They're too white. They're too poor. They're too fill in the blank. They're going to have it as an excuse. And so what we've been doing is having teams of students and teachers come in, and it looks like it's a student camp, but really the teachers are learning how to manage, develop this type of environment by doing it with the kids. And I we step back, I coach them, what are we doing here, why are we doing this, and it's really powerful and fun. Then, when they go back to the classroom, their school, wherever, there's a seed group of teachers and a seed group of experienced students who are like, oh my gosh, we totally know how to build this now. And then they can have it in their environment. Yeah.
So I'm gonna go beyond that question for a second. You go back to it, Todd, but... if you want to learn more about PBL, any books, blogs, websites, information that people can go out to get more, you know, resources on this?
Yeah. I say I like to work with the reluctant teachers. So I like to have them look at books that are really future-oriented. One of the most powerful that will help set the scene of why we need to do things differently is a book called The Coming Jobs War, if you haven't seen that. It's not brand new, but you could definitely take a look at that. Other great PBL is the Beck Institute.
I missed the title. Can you say it one more?
Yes, it's called The Coming Jobs War.
The Coming Jobs War.
Absolutely. And... other books, I know this isn't straight PBL, but it's really great, is Sylvia Martinez and Gary Steger have their Invent to Learn book, which is the mixture of PBL research. I mean, if you want a really good comprehensive view of research about learning by doing, that book is a great Invent to Learn, but it also steps into the makerspace area. Buck Institute is always...
Because that was what our guest, Jessica Allen from Santiago, Chile, she talked about makerspaces, and she said that was a must-read last week. And I know that after our interview next week, they've started an Invent to Learn book study this summer. I think their first chat is tomorrow, where they're just introducing themselves and planning a plan to actually read that book a bunch of people online. So that's funny that you mentioned that one, too.
Yeah, it's really powerful and an easy read. So not easy as easy, but easy. You know, it's not one that you're dreading to read.
There's authors out there like, nah, you know, my book's not easy.
Harry might say that. I think Sylvia would say, yeah, it's accessible. I'll talk plainly with those two about those two. Absolutely, any day of the week. They're not strangers. We're not strangers. And then, as I say, the Buck Institute is always a perennial favorite. For those teachers who are brand new, they've got amazing checklists and rubrics and stuff like that to go. I always caution, get away from those as soon as you can, because if you rely on those checklists, pretty soon it's doing projects, not project-based learning. But it's a great place to start. Also, Edutopia's PBL group is amazing. I always love to read Bianca Hughes. She's an Australian, mostly because she's extremely irreverent, and I appreciate that so much in a blogger and in a doer. H-E-W-E-S, Hughes. I'd say go there. And, of course, our website, or my website.
So Todd and I are typing back and forth to each other on this Google Doc. We're like, all right, we have this little back channel happening like between every interview, you know, like, okay, we're going to skip this one, move this one here and all that stuff. So people never actually see that until now. It's like the curtains have been unveiled on the show.
That's my favorite.
So lastly, like one of the questions that we always kind of end with is, what is something in education that you're super passionate about right now?
Yep. I've always been a bit of an iconoclast, somebody who, because of how I grew up in my own family life, as well as school, and being a bit of a dishonest person, you know, growing up and seeing that the rules aren't necessarily there as laws. Rules are rules, and rules can be changed, right? So I think the whole idea of what an iconoclast is about, and the thing that I did at Turning Point with parents and the kids is, what is the given in education? Okay, let's really think about that. Do we need to keep it? Do we need to tweak it? Do we need to check it out? Because I really believe, and that's not brand new in education, unless you look at the 192 years we've been doing this. That's what I'm really passionate about. It's PBL, it's makerspace, it's learning by doing, it's what is it we can and should be doing differently. That's all. Disruption? You want to call it that? I call it a comic.
Yes, let's call it both for sure. Well, thanks, Ginger. We really are like super excited. I'm personally super excited to hear about PBL. We haven't heard about it much, if at all, on any of our podcasts yet. So it's super exciting to talk to someone who's what we consider an expert in PBL for sure. Ways you can connect with us. Actually, let's talk about ways we can connect with you. How can people find you on Twitter, blogs, those kinds of things?
I'm Ginger Lumen everywhere. It's Lumen with an L. Sounds like Newman, only L-E-W-M-A-N. Ginger Lumen on Twitter, Ginger Lumen on Facebook. My website is gingerlumen.org. There's also our project-based learning website, which is lifepracticepbl.org. My website blog at gingerlumen.org is really where I do a lot of that irreverent thinking out loud, too. So,
perfect.
Yeah.
And then you can connect with us at EduAllStarsHQ on Twitter, hashtag EduAllStars. You can also find us at EduAllStars.com, or just go Google search EduAllStars. You'll find first 10 results are probably somewhere.
So. It is.
And we'd like to encourage you all to join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we talk with a teacher in Texas named Daisy Marino, and hear a little bit from her and her story. And then on July 29th, we will be speaking with Angela Watson. So it looks like July is our females-only month. All of our people in July are female educators, so we're excited to hear from all of them. And then we will look forward to speaking to those guests. We'd also like to thank this week's sponsor, Sophia, for sponsoring us, and we definitely encourage you to go check them out, show them some love on Twitter. They are sophia.org, S-O-P-H-I-A. And again, thank you so much, Ginger, for coming on tonight. It was awesome hearing from you and getting to hear a little bit of your story and then hearing all that great stuff about PBL. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
And we will see all of you next week.
Talk to you soon.